My name is Mabunap Gwynfor. I'm Senedd Member for Dwyfor Meirionnydd and have been a member since 2021 and been a member of Plaid Cymru since before I have any recollection of anything, if truth be told, and I was listening to the radio relatively recently. One of those radio programmes where the self-important intelligentsia discussed the political issues of the age on Radio 4, I think. And there was a political commentator making a comment that the most important person in the history of UK politics was Nigel Farage because of the way that Nigel Farage had transformed politics in the UK and in Britain in recent years. Now, there are a few things emerging from that that struck me. First of all, it's nonsense, of course, that the people who made those comments weren't aware of the history of the politics of these isles. Certainly, they weren't aware of the history of Welsh politics in making that comment. And also, that they weren't aware of the history of the UK and the British Isles. If one looks back to the period before the establishment of Plaid Cymru in 1925, one could say that what happened in Ireland between 1916 and 1921 had clearly changed the history of the UK and Britain because of the independence of the 26 counties and what happened to the six counties of the north. But then one could argue, so I certainly think, and I'm biased, of course, that Plaid Cymru is the political party that has been most successful, certainly in terms of its far-reaching influence on the makeup of the British Isles and the UK politically over the past 100 years. Because from 1925 onwards, we have seen huge change in the way that the British state is structured and the way that democracy is operated here. Now, if one looks at the name Nigel Farage and that comment, then the Judeo-Christian tradition has a lot to answer for. We have some obsession going back to the times of Moses of this idea that there is one individual, one man, more often than not, it is going to lead people to salvation. And following that tradition in Wales, we have this concept of the Mab Darogan, the son of prophecy. Well, that tradition, of course, there is a Hollywood appeal to it, yes, but it's simply not true, is it? Because our history in Plaid Cymru from 1925 onwards, we know that six people came together in Pwllheli, and there were many people in the background doing the work prior to that, and then Lewis Valentine got those 609 votes when Plaid Cymru had their first candidate in an election, and then in Carmarthen in 1966 there were 16,000 people and more who had supported the party at that point. And by 1997, with the high tide mark of the party's work and winning the devolution referendum, there were over 500,000 people who were involved in the movement and that growth. So it's never one individual who's ever responsible for these major political shifts, and it's not one person who has steered the party or the history of the party, as far as I'm concerned, at least. And I think it's very interesting as we think about the history of the party, and we will, of course, hear more about that in a few moments' time, that there has been an awakening, an awareness of the role of women in the history of Plaid Cymru. And that's been a recent development, I know certainly at a personal level, when one looks at the film made about Gwynfor Evans. For me, although Gwynfor was the central character in that film, the role of the women around him was very powerful indeed. And from a personal perspective, in thinking about Rhiannon, my grandmother, one sees the role of Rhiannon in what Gwynfor did. And although Rhiannon's part in the film was a minor role, without her, Gwynfor would not have succeeded in doing what he did. And that is true throughout the history of the party. And I know when listening to Arwel on the radio discussing the content of this book and hearing for the first time, I'm sorry to say, about the history of Mai Roberts and the role of some of the other prominent women in the party, showing that we have so much to be grateful for, so many people beyond those men that we usually hear about in the history of the party. There have been so many other people who have been involved in the fabric of the party and what's developed into the party that we have today. So there we are, the history. We're going to have a discussion in a few moments' time, and I look forward to that. But I will just mention how we've reached this point today, Plaid Cymru as it is today, and the quite unique position that we're in at the moment, namely that we are at quite an exciting point in our history. And if one believes the opinion polls, then there is a possibility that Plaid Cymru may help to form or may even lead the government here for the very first time. And that's certainly exciting. It's quite frightening in a way too, and it's also frightening because if it's not Plaid Cymru that leads, then the other option of course is reform, and I'd hate to think what the implications of that would be for Wales. But the fact that we are here at such an exciting point in our history, and that we can all witness this part of our history, and indeed in thinking how much has changed and how much has remained the same, then if you think back, and we'll discuss this, I'm sure, if you think back to why Plaid Cymru was formed, it was the fact that the UK government and the UK government never delivered for Wales, despite those pledges that they always made. Cymru Fydd saying, well, we'll do this and we'll do that, but not yet. There are other things that need to be done first. There are other priorities and requirements, but we will look at self-rule for Wales or home rule for Wales. And then just this week, we saw the Minister from Westminster, Timpson, in the Senedd here, providing evidence to one of our committees, and he said that no, the Westminster government won't devolve youth justice to Wales after all, despite the pledges made by the Labour Party, because they have more important things to do. So we'll do that at some other point in the future, soon, as they say in the Caribbean, but it never happens. So the need for Plaid Cymru is as great today as it was 100 years ago when the party was formed. And this is my final word, in order for us to make that difference next year, for us to succeed as a party, then we must run an election campaign and run local campaigns successfully. And to do that, we need support, and we need financial support. So if anyone of you knows anyone who'd like to contribute, then I would be more than happy to have a chat with you at the end of this evening. But there we go. We'll have a very interesting conversation now with Arwel Whipple, Gwen Griffith and Carl Davis. Now, there'll first of all be a presentation from Arwel and Gwen, and then there will be a conversation following that. So that will be our running order for this evening, and following the discussion you'll have an opportunity to discuss and buy a copy of the book if you've not bought one already. So without taking any more of your time, I will hand the reins over to Arwel and Gwen, and then Carl will join in the conversation later. Thank you. Oh yes, it's working. I wasn't quite sure. Well, as Mabon said, Arwel and Gwen are going to give a brief presentation talking about their work. I've had the privilege of reading this book already. I saw the proofs and read them earlier this month, or maybe last month even. And there's a feast awaiting you, I can promise that. Gwen, of course, is a researcher at the Centre for Celtic Studies, and Arwel is one of our finest historians and authors in contemporary Wales, and that powerful combination of their talents can clearly be seen in this volume, and it is truly an excellent book. You will enjoy reading it as well as learning a huge amount. because I thought I knew a lot about the history of the party, but there was a great deal that I didn't know. So I will hand over now to Arwel and Gwen, who will tell us a little about their experiences of writing this book. Thank you, Carl, for those kind words, too kind perhaps. I will start by giving you some background as to why we undertook this project. Clearly, it was the centenary of the party, and we'd both been discussing for quite some time that there was a need to do something. And we were both interested in those early days and how the party came into being. And one of the things that I was eager to do was to emphasize the fact that it was young people that created Plaid Cymru, people in their 20s and early 30s, because very often we see pictures of the big figures, Valentine DJ and Saunders, as old men. And then there's that idea, and because it's a long way back in time, we tend to think that they're old-fashioned and so on. But to the contrary, the National Party in its early days was a modern movement. As the strapline on the boot said, it was a modern movement for a modern age, and it reflected the influence of the age, and it was a very exciting time. It was exciting in terms of the arts, with modernism and so on, but it was also exciting politically. You'd had the Russian Revolution in 1917. The Great War, of course, cast a long shadow over that period, and more than anything, perhaps, in relation to Wales, the Irish War of Independence had happened at the end of the second decade of the 20th century, and that had a huge impact on a new breed of nationalists. So I wanted to demonstrate that in writing the book. Gwen, would you like to contribute? Is my microphone working? It is. Well, yes, we've been discussing this area for quite some time before we had, or before you had the idea that you would write this book to celebrate the centenary. And I think that's what we were discussing from the outset, that we wanted to emphasize the novel nature of this at the very outset, and I hope we've done that. You've said everything that I would have said. Well, if we can just give you a snapshot of how we approach this, but most of all, the events that led to the creation of the party. We start at the beginning, or at the cusp of the Great War, Cymru Fydd. The movement has, to all intents and purposes, come to an end. The main leader, Lloyd George, is now Chancellor of the Exchequer in the Asquith government. But not everyone has given up the ghost. One of the people who continued to hope for a Parliament for Wales and Home Rule was the MP for Denbighshire East, E.T. John. And he presented a Government of Wales bill, the first of its kind, in 1914. And that was presented on the back of a similar bill for Scotland. And we should note the content of this bill and see the similarity with where we are today, because under the terms of the bill, the Parliament in Westminster continue to control foreign policy, defence, taxes and the post office, but the proposed Welsh Parliament with 95 members would take responsibility for pensions, national insurance and some taxation powers. And the number of Welsh MPs would fall to 27, having been elected by proportional representation. And as you can see, the number of members and what happens to MPs is very similar to where we are today. So it's taken a century and 10 years for us to achieve the E.T. John bill. Well, not quite in terms of taxation powers, actually. However, the bill received the support of 11 MPs, a tiny number, if truth be told, 9 from Wales and 2 from Scotland. And the support of the Liberal government of Asquith didn't exist, if truth be told. They had no interest at all. And therefore the bill failed, naturally. And that, to all intents and purposes, is the end of any attempts to have home rule for Wales through Westminster before the Great War. And then, Gwen, you have a phrase that I like in relation to the Great War, that the old world had caught fire, quite literally, And of course, the burden usually falls on young people when it comes to resolving the problems caused by older people, and a whole generation of young people had to go through the mill of the Great War. And in the book, we look at two individuals who spent time in the British Army as part of the First World War, Lewis Valentine and Saunders Lewis. And the experiences that they had in the Great War was a reflection, or rather, their experiences in the First World War was very formative for them as they became Welsh nationalists. We'll start with Valentine. Valentine, when war broke out in 1914, he was a 21-year-old student at Bangor University studying divinity, and he hoped to go to become a minister, but he wanted to experience the full range of academia. He wanted to go to the Sorbonne in Paris, Heidelberg in Germany, and have academic and social experiences. But that didn't happen, of course. When war broke out in August 1914, he, like many young people of the time, had decided to join the army. Valentine joined the medical corps, which was created specifically to attract prospective ministers to the forces because they wouldn't have to carry arms. They were working in hospitals on the front line. Now, very soon, Valentine becomes disenchanted with what he called the English officer class, and he remains disenchanted for the rest of his life. The snobbery and the insulting attitudes towards the Welsh and people from less advantaged backgrounds. So throughout the war, he, or rather, his feeling of Welshness grows as the fighting continues, and by 1917, he believes that there is a class in Britain who would want to see the fighting continue because they would benefit from that war. Now, that leads to a growth in his pacifism too. But to cut a long story short, Valentine was seriously injured at Passchendaele. He was taken from the front line back to a hospital in England to recover from his injuries, but he was also transferred by a mistake or divine providence to Northern Ireland. He thought he was going to North Wales, but he'd made a mistake in filling the form and he ended up in Northern Ireland. But in Northern Ireland, he comes into contact with Irish nationalists, and as part of his recovery, men were allowed to leave the camps, and he met members of Sinn Féin whilst in Northern Ireland. And of course, Ireland at that time was at the verge of War of Independence. There'd been the Easter Rising 2 years earlier, and Valentine's comes into contact with these Sinn Féin members and is very impressed by the firmness and strength of their nationalism, the unyieldingness of it. And he and a colleague almost joined Sinn Féin at that time. And his life would have been entirely different if he had done that, of course, but he didn't. But the influence of Irish national remained with him for the rest of his life, making a huge impression on him. So Valentine leaves the war looking at a war for the smaller nations, but I came out of the war as a passionate nationalist. And Saunders Lewis was the other character, of course. He was an officer. Valentine was in the medical corps, as you mentioned, but Saunders Lewis was a soldier. Yes, the experience for Saunders Lewis was very different. He didn't despise his time in the army. He actually enjoyed the element of military discipline. And there's a memorable quote in a letter to his wife, or his prospective wife, Margaret, if I can quote this to you. Yes, he describes how he, in looking after his men in December 1916, and he was responsible for 4,000 men, and he said,
huts made waterproof, trees felled to provide timber and firewood, pumps built to draw water. It is a satisfactory sort of romance and suggests to me I should enjoy after the war going right out to the wilds of some virgin country and building cities and settlements.
Well, you can see there that that is a precursor of Saunders' desire to create a kingdom, if you like, to be responsible for one, to lead a group of people, to build a city, if you like. And I think that sparked an ambition in him, which is delivered as he moved on to establish Plaid Cymru. But also in France, he actually became disenchanted with his fellow English soldiers. He saw their attitude as a little boorish. As compared to the people of France, he loved socializing with the people of France. And that influence remained with him too. He was a committed European from that time. French authors had a huge influence on him too. And he too saw that desire to return to Wales and to change it for the better as he saw it. What else should we say about Saunders? Well, the only other thing is that he didn't become disenchanted with militarism as such. There is one other story. We don't want to go into too much detail here, perhaps, but he had an opportunity to kill an unarmed German. But we don't want to go into too much detail. Perhaps it's all in the book. We've included the description in the book. And Saunders Lewis was never boring in his writing. And he gives a portrayal of leading a corps out to no man's land, and they see a German fixing the barbed wire fence. And he could have shot him on the spot, but he refused to do so because the German had actually put his weapon down. And that shows Saunders Lewis's attitude, an aspect of his character, if you like, that element of dignity. A senior military officer doesn't kill an unarmed man. That's not pacifism, but it is an issue of military dignity and respect, and that runs through his life, through his literature and his politics. If on his return to Wales, Valentine returns to college in Bangor, do you want to tell us what he did there before I join in? Well, one thing I should say about Lewis Valentine, throughout his life, what's important to him is not so much words, but actions. He is a natural activist. When he gets back to college, he sees that Bangor University is very anglicized. The academic committees and the student committees are all run by the English. So he, with another group of Welsh people, J.P. Davis and Moses Griffith among them, who will also become a prominent figure in the history of the party, they establish a society called the Gwylliaid. And it's a half-secret society, but what they try and do is to take over all the student committees. And they're relatively successful, and they're trying to put Welsh representatives in place of the English, and they're partially successful in doing so. But another thing that Valentine does, he became president of the Students' Union at this point in 1920, 1921, and he leads a series of protests to condemn the British policy in Ireland. And Lloyd George, who was prime minister by this point, so Valentine, as one of the spokespeople for this new young generation, goes head to head with the leader of Cymru Fydd. It is a political rebellion, if you like. And during this period, there is an election held at the University College of North Wales, and one of the candidates is Moses Griffith, and Moses Griffith stands as a national. It was during Rag Week, but it was taken seriously. And Moses Griffith won that election, and he has quite a funny story. He says that he remembers some of his supporters standing at the ballot boxes challenging other students coming to vote, are you an Englishman or a man? So those tensions were running very high, I think, and Moses Griffith, as we mentioned here, had some threatening letters during that period too. So Valentine actually implemented his nationalist beliefs immediately. And there'd been other things happening at Aberystwyth College a little earlier, hadn't there, during the war? Yes, Aberystwyth, during the war, there was a group that had gone to Aberystwyth, people like Ambrose Bebb, Griffith John Williams and so on, Elizabeth Williams, who was the wife, became the wife of Griffith John, and also DJ Williams, who was a little older than them. But they all shared the same ideas of this new nationalism, as I would describe it. And DJ, there was an article by DJ, sorry, there were regular articles by DJ in Awawr, which is a student publication. And there was one article particular in the middle of the war, which praised conscientious objectors, Sinn Féin and the Germans. So obviously, this didn't go down at all well with prominent Welsh people. O.M. Edwards accused the author of treason, for example. So Awawr was a means for these students to express their newfound feelings and their newfound nationalism. Bebb became editor for a time. He published more inflammatory or bold articles by DJ, or progressive articles, if you like. He also had editorials in praise of Sinn Féin in 1918, I believe. But that, of course, created huge trouble within the college, and the story is in more detail in the book, but the end point is that the magazine is forced to close down, the editorial board resigns. But it had actually provided them with great strength, I would say. And are we turning back to North Wales now? Because it wasn't just academics and students who had been working and had been inspired by Ireland and this idea that something new had to be done to change the modus operandi in Wales, and Gwen will cover this. There was another group of nationalists in Arfon, in the slate quarrying area specifically, and this group was inspired by Ireland. But they were working class to a great extent, and their politics was more left-wing, but they also saw the need for a national party, an independent Welsh national party, free from the influence of the English parties. Now, the great innovator among them was H.R. Jones from Dunollen, and he was a son of a quarryman, and he'd follow his father into the quarry at 14 years of age, and he was characteristic of someone from that background at that time. He had actually become cultured by reading broadly about the history and culture of Wales and Irish history too, very significantly. But he had to leave the quarry at the time of the First World War because of health issues. It was TB. And he had to become a traveller. But another job that he had very significantly is that he worked as secretary for Arfon and Eifionydd for the Union of Welsh Societies. And we do cover this in detail in the book. We can't cover it today, but it's an organisation that's quite significant and part of the backdrop to the situation at the time and the response of the younger generation to the old ways of doing things. But what we can say now here this evening, that it's significant in the fact that it provided an opportunity for HR to get to know people of a similar mindset. And that was very important because by the beginning of 1924, HR had thought that something needed to be done. He was desperate to do something for Wales. And what he did was to correspond with everyone that he thought would sympathise with his view in wanting to see things happening, and not only corresponded with them, but also invited them to a series of meetings in Caernarfon, at the Queen's Cafe, in fact, in Caernarfon, to have further discussions. And there was something between 40 and 50 people attending these meetings regularly, according to the evidence of those in attendance. They were ordinary workers, for the most part, from nearby villages, but there were also representatives from the Welsh Society at Bangor University, the Three Cs, as they were known, and that developed out of this student body that Valentine and Moses Griffith had been involved with. They're the next generation of students, if truth be told, aren't they? And also some former students that you've already mentioned, such as Valentine, Moses Griffith and JP, they would attend these meetings in Caernarfon too. And the other group involved, quite significantly, was journalists, and they were there, some of them as correspondents, but they were sympathetic too. So Meirin, the editor of Herald Gymraeg, and Gwilymar Jones, who worked for him, and it struck me that there was something akin to a seiat to these meetings in Caernarfon, because everyone would get up and express their visions and feelings, but it wasn't coordinated really in any way. There were some who would put the emphasis on the importance of the Welsh language, whilst others would discuss home rule or different forms of home rule, but nothing was ever decided or organised as a way forward. Is it worth reading that quotation from Valentine, perhaps? Because these meetings were notoriously poorly arranged, because we quote, because it's not us saying this, it was Valentine who was in attendance, and he said that these meetings, of course, were quite funny in retrospect. Everyone had their own story and everyone had their own theory. The strangest mix you've ever seen, without much by way of order. I don't have enough hands to do this. Without much order in any way whatsoever, but we couldn't stop going to these meetings. And one other quote, where he says that the meetings were lengthy with a lot of rambling. We leave downhearted, but then still feel that there is nothing else to be had. We must press ahead. And HR, of course, was still doing his best time and time again to try and bring people together and bring them to some sort of order. By September, he'd got the group to adopt a name, Byddin Ymreolwyr Cymru, the Welsh Home Rule Army, and many of the attendees were lost. Some were coming because they were curious, some came just to laugh at some of the contributors, but some of those were lost as they formalized into a movement, but it was a step forward. By this point, they had membership cards with an oath of allegiance to the Army of Home Rule, which shows the influence of Ireland. They did have a headline paper, which meant that they had headed paper, which meant that they could send press releases and correspond more formally as a group so they could campaign. And they also elected officials. Haytar Jones himself was the secretary. And some of these ordinary people were the other officials. Gwallden Llyfri was a friend of Bob Owen Croesodd and Carneddog. Those cultured workers was the president, and Ivan Alwyn Owen from Rhyddi was the treasurer, and Ivan Alwyn was one of the ones that corresponded most with HR during this period. He was full of ideas. The chair of the meeting, however, was Dr. Lloyd Owen. He had long been calling for whole room. Well, yes, he'd established a number of societies and associations in support of home rule, but unfortunately, these organizations were like mushrooms. They grew very quickly and then withered away overnight. Well, E.T. John, who was a colleague of his, said that he was more successful in establishing organizations than actually nurturing their development. And another thing, the doctor was an eccentric, he was a difficult character, and people didn't really understand what he said very often. They certainly didn't understand his writings. His handwriting was very difficult to understand, for one thing, and he also actually tended to actually upset people. But he was sincere. Well, yes, he was sincere. It's difficult to be too harsh on him. But he was one of the ones mainly responsible for the chaos and arguments that emerged from these meetings in the cafe. And another thing, the new movement couldn't agree on its campaigning approach. Was it to be constitutional, non-constitution? Some, like Ivan Alwyn, wanted them to follow the line of Sinn Féin. but the doctor really warned against that. Not everyone agreed on the name of the movement, the use of the word army of Welsh Home Rule. Some saw that as being insensitive for those who had lost loved ones in the First World War. And of course, it was out of sync with increasing pacifism in Wales in the early 20s. And then there were others such as Moses Griffith and Valentine who just saw this as an absurd name because it would draw more derision. Now, by December 1924, there was an official motion put forward to change the name and to reorganise the army and to formulate a political party that would put candidates forward in elections, and the name would be Plaid Genedlaethol Cymru. Now, as this happened, the Welsh Society at Bangor University, the 3Cs, formally joined the Caernarfon group, which was the first part of the merger, if you like, but that didn't happen without opposition. There were some, like Ivan Alwyn, who was treasurer, and he opposed that. They saw it as the cockerels of the university were trying to take over from the ordinary people, and they thought, well, give us a chance. The university types have already failed, but they did come together. And that's another thing about this group in North Wales, this endless argument and bickering. The archive is full of letters to H.R. Jones where they are criticising each other and they're just carrying personal stories and scandals, if truth be told. And you can imagine the frustration of H.R. with all of this. He was trying to bring order and he was trying to do something to save Wales, and they were just bickering amongst themselves. And the truth was that despite the oath of allegiance, there was hardly any order, whatever the name was. And this, and the lack of unity of purpose, and the hair splitting on issues from the Welsh language to Home Rule itself, actually meant that there couldn't be any stability in the movement. It wasn't just HR that was frustrated, you became frustrated too. Well, yes, I find this hugely disenchanting because I'd been romanticising this group, and I'm not the only one. I like the idea of these cultured quarrymen that had established the National Party. I'm from that background myself, and that's my research background too. I'd done some research on the popular culture of the quarries, and I wanted this to be true. And I'd been doing research on this for around 18 years. And I'd been doing research for this month, for this book, for 6 or 7 months. And Easter last year, and I'd taken a week to be in the National Library to do a real deep dive into the archive just to see what would happen. And they became no closer to formulating something that could last. And I was lost in this. I was in 1924, apart from the fact that I had a phone in my hand and I was texting Arwell. But there was a slight panic coming over me. They're not going to form anything. There will be no centenary. There'll be no party and there'll be no book. What are we going to do? Well, Arwell said, well, you're there for the week. Why don't you look beyond Arfon just to see what was happening elsewhere? Okay, fair enough, I thought. And then I was at the National Library where the papers of many of the other characters were held. So I had to look then at what was happening with another group of nationalists who were meeting in Penarth in South Wales. And this was the Mudiad Cymreig. Now, the core of that movement was those who had been students in Aberystwyth during the war. As Arwell's mentioned already, by that time, Griffith John Williams had married Elizabeth Roberts and both lived in Penarth. And they'd kept in touch with Ambrose Bebb, who by that time was a lecturer in the Sorbonne. Griffith John and Ambrose Bebb were school friends, and all three of them were college friends. And during 1923, Griffith John also got to know Saunders Lewis. And Saunders Lewis had been making a name for himself during that year. Yes, in 1923, Saunders Lewis made something of a name for himself academically as a literary critic, but also for the purposes of this evening's conversation, he gave three speeches during 1923, one to Cymdeithorion y Bari, one at Mould, at the Mould Eisteddfod, and one in Llandrindod, and all three speeches set out his stall intellectually and politically. and specifically on what he saw as the future of Wales and how Wales could progress. The most significant of these that we can discuss today is the speech he gave in Mold. He gave that speech under the sponsorship of the 3C Society, and he's got to know Moses Griffith during that previous year, and Moses Griffith invited him to speak at the meeting, and the meeting actually caused quite a rumpus because the substance of it, and we're being brief this evening, but he said that he was suspicious of every conference. There was a series of conferences that had been held in previous years. There's been a lot of talking, a lot of hot air, and nothing happening. And people would leave there losing all hope. And this is very different to what happens in the Queen's Cafe, because the people who were going to the conference were Liberal MPs and so on, trying to find a way forward, but they couldn't reach agreement. And there were many motions that were passed without any real benefit. He also said that I don't have much confidence in the national movement in Wales because political honesty is too rare among the current crop, and there is no reason to believe that they wouldn't be tempted by English parties. So he suggests there that it's not through the British parties that the future of the national cause sits. Because he also goes on to say that a political movement is crucial if Welsh culture is to prosper sooner or later. And by culture, he doesn't just mean the arts. He means culture in its broadest sense, which is society and economy. And then the thing that upset most people is that he suggested it would be a good idea to formulate a battalion and a Welsh camp, and every Welshman who wishes to serve his country could come there and to drill for a fortnight and to adhere to military orders so that they have a lesson in working together quietly without argument, everyone actually being willing to take orders and take punishment if they refuse. And we heard about the bickering among nationalists and home rulers at that time, and Saunders Lewis gives a shot across the bows, as it were, in order that they should hear. And there's quite some response in the press, well, particularly in the English press in Wales, yes. They see this as some new Sinn Féin being established in Wales, and Saunders Lewis writes to Moses Griffith, and he's delighted by this. He's very pleased because at least there is something happening, even if it's just a response to his ideas. And there are some who are delighted to read this. Ambrose Bebb is delighted, certainly. Well, it's after the Llandrindod speech, and he says in his diary that he can't sleep because he's read a summary in a banner, and he thinks, well, somebody thinks the same things as me. Well, the fact that Griffith John Williams and Elizabeth, his wife, were very eager to bring these two people together for some time, Ambrose Bebb and Saunders Lewis. They'd been trying to do that for quite some time, but Ambrose Bebb isn't home very often. He's been home for Christmas and he's still around at the beginning of January 1924. Saunders Lewis is also free, so they managed to invite both to stay with them for the weekend in Penarth. And Griffith Jones writes the letters, but one senses that it's Elizabeth that actually pushing things in the background, telling Griffith John to do this and to bring them together. So the beginning of January 1924, all four meet. At the end of the weekend, Saunders writes to his future wife, Margaret, and says that he had a wonderful time having discussions until daybreak and then sleeping until noon, sleeping on the sofa in Griffith John's study. So they were having some fun. They weren't just discussing politics. There's been a little drink taken. But what happened during those discussions was is that all four agreed that they would form a secret society with the aim of saving Wales from its current state and turning it into a Welsh-speaking Wales. The main points in the minutes of that first meeting is, first of all, that all of the activities of the movement should be held within Wales, fighting local and parliamentary elections, but that they would not send any successful candidates to Westminster. And then secondly, that the success of the organisation would rely on full cooperation, and therefore that there needed to be an oath of allegiance to the Pwyllgor Gwaith, namely the three of them, and that the organisation should be a secret society and that nobody should reveal its existence to everyone else without the approval of fellow officers or officials, and the influence of Ireland is strong on all of those points. They talked about inviting other members to join with them too, but most of those names were rejected, including W.J. Griffith and T.H. Barry Williams. But two names that they did invite was D.J. Williams and Fred Jones. Now, D.J., a week after that first meeting, Ambrose Bebb had returned to France, and Saunders writes to him saying, okay, contact DJ Williams to invite him. What he didn't realise was that Ambrose Bebb had already done that off his own bat. He was so eager to include his old friend within the movement. And what then happened is that DJ agreed to meet with Saunders one Saturday afternoon in Swansea on the day of a rugby international between Wales and England. And they had discussions for 2 hours with Saunders outlining his ideas and how the new movement would work, and asking DJ to write back to him within a fortnight if he would agree to join. Now, DJ didn't decide immediately. He took time to think about this, which is a little surprising at first sight, but not that surprising either. We think of DJ as one of the foremost nationalists of that generation, but we must bear in mind that he had strong socialist beliefs at this time, and he'd been active with the ILP in Pembrokeshire at the time. But once he had decided to join, there was no turning back. Well, yes, it's significant in terms of DJ's character. This was how he was at the time of Penyberth, when Saunders Lewis asked him whether he was willing to be one of the three to act at Penyberth. He admits himself that caused him a great deal of anguish, but once DJ decided something, he would not turn back, and that's how he is when he joins with the rest of the Mudiad Cymreig group. And the second name that they'd agreed upon was Fred Jones, the Reverend Fred Jones, who was the grandfather of Dafydd Iwan and Alan Fred, of course. He was one of the Ciliai boys, and by that time he was a minister with the Independents at Treorchy. He was a great campaigner for Welsh medium education in the valleys. And also, he was the only one of them who had direct political experience in the fact that he had fought a local election already in 1921 and came within a hair's breadth of winning. And he also agreed to join the Mudiad Cymreig. So these two new recruits were present in the second meeting that was held at Saunders Lewis's home in Mumbles in May 1924. And there were more there too. I think it was either six or eight. Well, we don't know. There were six or eight there. Nobody says seven. But Ambrose Bebb was of the view that that meeting had gone superbly, but Saunders Lewis wasn't so sure. And he wrote to DJ saying that he didn't see the point of holding another meeting unless there was something specific that they wanted to do. And you can understand that the president of this new movement, Ambrose Bebb, was spending most of his time in France and in Brittany. And the main propaganda instrument was a Breton publication that hardly anyone in Wales knew of its existence. And Griffith John Williams, in years to come, would complain about how naive they'd been in that. So although there was more depth and intellectual substance in the South Wales movement, the truth is that they too were slightly impractical in their approach. Again, this was a more select Seyat. Well, it was more intellectual as well, wasn't it? Which brings us in the narrative, in the story, if you like, it's a little bit of a stalemate. The group in North Wales are disorganized, but very sincere, and they do want to see change, and they want to see something happen, but they can't deliver it. The group in South Wales are more select and more intellectually rigorous, but they seem to be unable to take the next step, and they're also a secret society. Well, yes, you've made the point, but it's true. We slightly disagree on this, don't we? But that brings us to what actually happens. And a new character, some of you will have already heard her name, Mai Roberts, from Deiniolen. Mai is a young woman of around 21 or maybe 22. Where are we now? 1924. She's 25. She's in her early 20s at least. And she is the private secretary to E.T. John. E.T. John, as you may recall, was Liberal MP in Denbighshire East. By the end of the war, he turned to the Labour Party mainly because of his opposition to the war and conscription and so on. But he lost his seat in the 1918 election. But he was still a wealthy industrialist, and he employed Mai as a private secretary. He'd also stood in a number of elections and by-elections in the name of the Labour Party. And in the general election of 1924, I believe, am I right? I'm getting a bit confused by the dates here. But the Labour leader, Ramsay MacDonald, and the general secretary of the party, Arthur Henderson, come to E.T. John asking him to stand as a candidate in the general election in Breconshire. And another who was at that meeting was Mai Roberts. And I think you have a quote here. Mai described what happened. If you just give a little more background, they'd had an invitation over breakfast. So when she's talking about being around the table, that's what she means. The message of the two members of the Labour Party was to ask E.T. John to stand for the party for the third time in Brecon and Radnor. His response that he would do so on one condition, namely that the Labour Party, when it actually formed a government, would legislate for home rule for Wales. Now, I remember shaking my head at E.T. John, who was facing me around the table, but in vain. He agreed. What happened? When the Labour Party formed a government in 1929, Ramsay MacDonald refused to consider a Secretary of State for Wales. And this is characteristic, and Mai says further in her memoirs that Welsh nationalists should never trust in the pledges made by the Labour Party, which may be irrelevant today, perhaps, who knows. But what's also significant is that it's Mai that arranges the electoral campaign of E.T. John in Brecon and Radnor. She has that experience of organising a campaign, and it should be said that Mai is a committed nationalist. She is from Deiniolen, and she knows H.R. Jones. Perhaps I should explain that she is also a modern woman of her time. She has her own car, she wears makeup, she wears fashionable clothes. She is an independent woman, and she knows her own mind. However, she has that political experience of organising the campaign, and we should also bear in mind that women didn't have the vote until 1929. So she's organising a campaign, although she had no vote in that general election. E.T. John had also re-established the Celtic League after the Great War, and Mai is given the work of arranging the work of the Celtic League. And in 1924, their meeting is held in Kemper in Brittany. And are you going to read a quote there from the meeting? Yes, you might as well. In Kemper, she has a meeting once again. I well remember arriving at the hotel and seeing a tall man standing before the fireplace in the hall. I'd never met Beb, and I had no idea what kind of man he was physically, short or tall, fat or thin. But by instinct, I suddenly had the idea that this man was Ambrose Bebb. I turned to E.T. John, who was behind me, and I said through my teeth, "I'm sure that's Ambrose Bebb." E.T. John walked straight up to him, saying, "Ambrose Bebb, isn't it? I'm E.T. John, and this is Miss Mai Roberts, my secretary, one of your biggest fans." And that's the beginning of a friendship that lasts their whole lives between Mai and Ambrose Bebb. Mai becomes a very close friend of the family in due course too. But in terms of our story this evening, both discuss the situation in Wales. Mai tells Bebb about H.R. Jones's movement, and he says that he was greatly encouraged by that. And then he told me confidentially that I don't doubt that I had to give an oath that I wouldn't mention this to anyone. But having questioned me and cross-examined me, he actually invited me to join the secret society. I then started to question him, and this went on for some days. And he told me that another member of the organisation would have to come and see me to see whether I was safe to join such an important organisation. Well, this is joining an underground, almost terrorist movement. Of course, it wasn't a terrorist movement, but it has that feel. We'll cut a long story short again and say that what happens in the end is that Saunders Lewis contacts Mai, and he arranges to meet her when he is speaking at a meeting in King's Cross in London. And you want to use Mai's words again? The next thing was that I received a letter from Saunders Lewis inviting me to dine with him in a London restaurant. As his friends knows, Saunders Lewis is a connoisseur of both food and wine, and she doesn't then finish the sentence, which is a shame. After a long discussion on home rule, I told him that I wouldn't be willing to settle for anything less than Ireland, namely a free state, and that that was the view of E.T. John too. I was accepted into this group in South Wales. So Mai is a member of the Mudiad Cymreig, and she also has close links with the group in North Wales. She goes home between autumn and Christmas 1924, and comes to the family home in Dynolen, but H.R. Jones. And the conversation turns to that. H.R. Jones speaks enthusiastically, as he always did, I think, about the progress that the movement is making in North Wales. But then Mai says, "It came to me suddenly, I wonder whether it would be possible to bring both organisations together. Couldn't we talk to HR about the secret society in South Wales?" But I told him that the Caernarfon group couldn't form a party and call it a national party if South Wales wasn't involved. So what Mai is doing is that she's not allowed to talk about the organisation in South Wales because she's taken an oath saying that she would never do that. But what she can do is talk about individuals. And she tells HR that there are nationalists in the South, and you've read their articles in the press. DJ Williams is one, isn't he? And Ambrose Bebb is another one, isn't he? And I'm sure that Saunders Lewis is another, wouldn't you think? And then what happens ultimately is that HR takes the bait and he contacts Saunders Lewis in the new year, and then there is correspondence between the two. We won't go into it because time is against us. But ultimately, Saunders lays down his conditions and HR is more than happy to accept them all without question, because he sees this as the saviour of the North Wales group. HR, like Mai and Saunders Lewis himself, feel that there must be a united party covering both North and South. There's no point in saying we're Plaid Cymru and we're based in North Wales. And likewise with the Mudiad Cymreig. So unity is crucial, and HR is willing to accept all of those conditions. Yes, everyone. We go into more detail in the book, of course. We won't go into it now, but they do decide to establish the Plaid Genedlaethol, and the meeting to do that happened at the Bwlleli Eisteddfod in August 1925. Now, one could argue that Plaid Genedlaethol Cymru was established in December 1924, but Plaid Genedlaethol Cymru, that was in its original form, that was the North Wales Party. Everyone who was involved in these arrangements, it's agreed that the National Party came into existence in Pwllheli, and it's not just those who are involved in the organisation. Well, those who are involved, and it's important to say that H.R. Jones and Valentine's are the one who are tasked with organising the meetings in Pwllheli, and Valentine himself says on a number of occasions that he considered Pwllheli to be the starting point. After Pwllheli, we will have the authority of a nation. I think what he means by that is that North and South come together. Ambrose Bebb also says that in a letter to Griffith John, that the new party came into existence in Pwllheli, and editors who are sympathetic to the party, such as Prosser Rhys, the editor of Yfanwr, Meirin yr Herald, and J. Tywy Jones, the editor of Darien, they all see Pwllheli as the starting point. It's not necessarily a myth that's been created by the party. There were people who believed it at the time, and I think the research shows that. But the people involved believed that at the time too. So they go on to arrange two meetings in Pwllheli. HR and Valentine are responsible for the arrangements mainly. And then in the famous cafe in Maesgwyn, there are six in attendance. We could name them. So Maurice Griffith, David Edmund Williams, one of the North Wales group. I can't remember. HR, Valentine, Saunders and Fred Jones. They were in attendance, and that's the first time that Valentine and Saunders met each other, although both had been on a dual track in the same direction. They'd never met each other until that point. And Valentine states, in listening to Saunders Lewis talking in the cafe, although there was the clatter of cups and saucers and so on, he said that what Saunders Lewis said had had an impact on him for the rest of his life, and that he decided from that moment that he would have his full support. And I think what happens there is not only that he develops a political vision, but this idea that we have something that is well organized, someone knows what they want to do, rather than this endless conversation that had existed before then. So there were six in attendance, but there were more who were supposed to be there. Yes, there were eight, but the seventh was Mai Roberts again. So if Mai had got there on time, there would have been a woman involved in the mythology of the establishment of the party, because she worked for the Celtic League. She was held up in Dublin and she missed the ferry to get to Pwllheli on time. And the eighth? Oh no, hang on. Mai arrived the next day, didn't she? And the first thing she did was look for HR, and she was the first member, I believe. Yes, she was the first member of the party. And the eighth was DJ Williams. DJ Williams, of course, characteristically had missed the train and had arrived late, but there to meet him on the platform at Pwllheli station was Saunders Lewis. And the first words the Saunders uttered when he met DJ was that it has started. And that's where we are a century later. From a home in Penarth to cafes in Caernarfon and in Pwllheli, a century later, where they're in the shadow of a Senedd established to a great extent because of the inspiration of these people a century ago. And there we are, Carl. Well, thank you both very much. The first thing I would say is that gives us a flavour of the book, but you haven't heard everything, so don't think that just listening this evening is good enough. You do need to read the book. There is so much more to learn within it. But I think you have had a flavour of it, and it is a wonderful book, and you are real storytellers. Now, there were many things that struck me, but one thing was you talked about the bickering and the lack of order and so on. Now, one of the things that I would think that was characteristic of the party from the beginning was its unity, and it's a party that hasn't really been bickering for the whole of that century. Now, I was wondering whether the Ysgol Haf, the summer school, had played a central role in that, and also that had built some esprit de corps and given ownership to members of the party itself. Well, yes, I think in the meeting in the cafe in Pwllheli, I think I'm right in saying that a decision was taken to establish annual summer schools. And over ensuing years, those summer schools were a way of cementing the unity of the party among its members and creating some unity and camaraderie, if you like, within the ranks. And I think it's Jay Jones who says about Valentine and DJ that both of them were very well-liked characters, but they were also determined. So they would socialise and have fun, but they were also very serious about their beliefs and about their politics. And I think that the summer schools were crucial in the survival of the party during those early decades. One gets that impression, and moving on to a later time in Jay's book, he emphasises the importance of that, and again emphasises the importance of Plaid's machinery, if you like. And one of the things that surprised me, that I didn't expect perhaps, and you've referred to it more than once already this evening, was the need to have order in all of this. And also the image that we have of some of these leaders is because we have known them in their latter years, and the difference between that and how they truly were 100 years ago. And Saunders Lewis, we think of him as this author and dramatist in his ivory tower, but as you've suggested this evening, he was entirely practical in his approach and well organized, and if he hadn't been, then the party would never have formed and never would have succeeded. Do you want to take that one? Well, yes, he was a key player, wasn't he? He, as Gwen suggested, he even saw with the Mudiad Cymreig that we were getting nowhere. We need a bigger vehicle and we need to actually arrange this properly. And he turns his back on the secret nature of Mudiad Cymreig to be part of the party. Things still strike us, don't they? As we were saying yesterday, it might be significant that he writes to DJ saying that, who was another who was looking to the future very much rather than wanting to remain as a sort of secret society. DJ had joined the North Wales group. He was a member of both organisations. Well, HR invited him, didn't he? But that was pre-Pwllheli, so he was very eager, because there were people in both organisations who wanted to remain. People feel ownership of their own little organisations and wanted to remain the same forever. But like Saunders, DJ was eager to move forward and to develop this properly. But to your point on discipline, yes, I think it is crucial. I don't think the party would have survived without having someone like him actually laying down the law, if you like. But the law had to be laid down, because otherwise everyone would go in their own directions. And as I mentioned, there's the military background and the discipline, and all of it feeds in. Of course, there are disbenefits to that, but in this context of establishing the party, he was a key player. Now then, any questions from the audience? We do have a little more time. Just wait for the microphone, if you will, so that everyone can hear. Thank you very much. It's been extremely interesting. One of the things that I'm very interested in is this great secrecy. Why the secrecy? Is there anything that you've discovered as part of your research which has given you some insight as to why they wanted to keep everything so quiet and so confidential? Well, two things I would say there. The obvious thing is the Irish influence, even on the Penarth group. The Republican movement in Ireland had to be a secret movement, and that influence is clear. The influence of other nationalist organisations, such as the one in Italy in the 19th century, mentioned him, but it was Ben Bowen Thomas who said that. Well, yes, he was a member too, wasn't he? Yes, he was. And they compare the organisations to these secret societies in Italy. So there is a romantic element to this, but there's also a practical issue. And another thing that I would say that is true, and it's true of Bebb and Saunders Lewis too, that they don't want people spouting hot air. They've had enough of those conference goers and people just spouting on and on, wanting to hear their own voices. They want people who want to take action in earnest, and therefore they are very selective in terms of who they choose and people they trust. But it's difficult to see how that could have moved on. They've decided they're going to fight elections. But if they're a secret organization, who are they going to stand as? Under what banner? So you could see that it lasted for a year. But could such an organization have survived if Mai and HR hadn't invited them, or invited Saunders at least, to join? Then what would have happened? But Saunders Lewis himself didn't see the point of continuing with those meetings. I think both organizations needed to come together. Yes, because they'd got into a cul-de-sac that both Saunders and Beb would have enjoyed. But HR and his organization provided salvation for him just as much as it was the case vice versa. Thank you very much, Gwen and Arwel. Now, there is a reason that it says Elsie Mai Roberts on my daughter's birth certificate. Well, yes, she named her daughter after mine. But I look forward to reading this book and using them in modules for years 1 and 2, so that's great. A question about HR Jones and the North Wales group, that more working class group, and I know that you've done some research on the quarrying communities of North Wales. Can we see any echo or influence of the Great Strike at the Penrhyn Quarry at the beginning of the 19th century on the formation of the movement in bringing together the labour movement and Welsh identity? Well, yes, certainly, and there is some common language used. In fact, we were discussing this very recently. It's not just on that working class group, but also in the group at Bangor University too. Arwel mentioned the campaign of Moses Griffith in that false election, the fact that they would stand at the ballot box asking, are you an Englishman or a man? Now, during the great strike at the Penrhyn Quarry, of course, as what was seen as traitors or a Bradwyr returned to work, there were a group of strikers on the bridge saying, are you a traitor or are you a man? I don't want to overemphasize that. That might be a more general thing. But there wasn't a great deal of influence then. There are echoes of it, certainly, and that's even used. And I don't want to talk too much about this, but there's the most famous ballad, Painter Come From the Penrhyn Strike, and they say Deithar Horbin can buy men. And you see the language of that time, and that does have an influence, but I'm sure that there are other influences too. For one thing, it's not perhaps as heroic in nature, but the other side of the coin is that if you look at the names of the people that joined the party in the Ogwen Valley in the early days, and some of those were seen as the Bradwyr from the Great Strike because there was no home for them in the Labour Party because of their background. They weren't happy with becoming Tories and they turned their backs on the Liberal Party, which had been the party of the strike. So that's not perhaps as romantic and heroic, but that is another aspect, certainly, and one sees that. And there are references to that. There is a street in Dyffryn Ogwen, Stryd y Gymffon, and these were houses built for those who had broken the strike, the Blacklegs. And there is more than one family that joins the party in those early years. Sorry, I've gone into my favourite area and I will stop there. But thank you there for drawing me into that. Yes, my second favourite area. Thank you very much. Of course, around this time, the other DJ had become a member of the party, DJ Davis. And he, of course, was a non-Welsh speaker. What was the role of non-Welsh speakers during this period in the formation of the party? Well, not much, if truth be told. Are you aware of anything? Well, The Welsh nation, or the Welsh nationalists, as it was originally called, didn't come into existence until 1932 with Rai Goch. Goch had established in 1926, and there was some dissatisfaction with that. MacWilliams was eager to see a vehicle to attract non-Welsh speakers. You wanted to see a publication, but you had other people like Iorwerth Pete, who, we haven't mentioned him, but he was very active in the early days. We haven't really talked about Math, and maybe we should talk about Math for just a second. Marianne is here, and she knows far more than me about Math. But Math came from a wealthy, cultured family, to get a long story short. And she was the reason. If we wanted one individual who would have ensured the survival of the party, I think it's her that I would turn to because of her great financial donations in those early days. She was very generous, and she wanted to see the establishment of an English language publication for the Glamorgan area. She said that Glamorganshire had to be one because that's where the population is, and therefore you needed an English medium periodical. But that didn't happen until the early 30s, as Gwen said. But Math does provide a great deal of funding to the party. She funds H.R. Jones's job as organizer. She is responsible for funding Adrai Goch, which is the first monthly publication, and we say a lot more about that in the book. She gave huge amounts. It was corresponding to some £3,000 or £4,000. And Saunders Lewis himself says that without those financial donations made by Math, Clyde wouldn't have survived those early days. She placed the party in a viable financial position to all intents and purposes. And she says that the English medium publication is required at a time when others haven't even started discussing that. But even before the Pwllheli meeting, she has said that this is needed. And as I suggested, there were others who weren't content with that, such as Iorwerth Pete, and that's one of the reasons he left. One of the reasons, yes. As one who was brought up in Abergele, I would like to think that this wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for an Abergele resident, Emrys Ap Iwan. And had he lived longer and not died as a young man, that he would have been there with them. I was hoping you'd ask this question. Am I a romantic? Well, Arwel is too. Well, I have roots in the Llandilas and Abergele area, and Emrys Ap Iwan is central to the intellectual development of this group of young people. Saunders Lewis buys a copy of T. Gwyn Jones' his memoir, biography of Emrys Ap Iwan, and he later says that this is a biography that has had a transformational effect on a whole generation, and it's true. And if I remember correctly, Griffith John Williams and his brother, the language of their correspondence changes from English to Welsh, having read T. Gwyn Jones's biography of Emrys Ap Iwan. And Valentine, of course, is from that same area again, and he regularly talks about the importance of the ideas of Emrys Ap Iwan. And the political ideas of Emrys Ap Iwan are surprisingly contemporary now. Apart from the campaigning for the Welsh language, and perhaps we haven't placed enough emphasis on that element in the establishment of the party this evening, but one of Emrys's ideas is that there should be two parties in Wales. One British anglicised party and one Welsh party, and the aim of the Welsh party should be to weaken the English party until we achieve our freedom, and that's relatively contemporary. If you see the polarization in Wales, that should be the aim, perhaps, if I can make that suggestion. But it's not my place to do that, perhaps. Do you have anything to add on Emrys? No, you're his biggest fan. You talk about him in your fiction and everything. Well, it appears to me that, as well as one who inspired Saunders, that he was one who was a precursor to him, one of the few in that Cymru Fydd period who saw how futile the whole idea behind Cymru Fydd was and saw through it And he said that we don't need to disestablish the church, we need self-government and home rule, and there was no one else saying that in the 1880s. He was very much before his time, wasn't he? And in today's terms, you could describe Emrys as the greatest anti-colonialist that the national movement has had or had at that time, and then his influence. And one thing is true of the party, and a silver thread running through the party from those early days to the contemporary times is this anti-imperialist and anti-British element. And that's what links 1925 with 2025, if you like. Any further questions? We have a little time remaining. Now, just to return to the point that you've just made. Now, given all the research that you've done, what's the most important thing that you've learned from that research that you could actually use to inspire us now as we look to next year? So what's the most interesting or important thing that we should consider as we approach the 2026 election? Unity. Yes, unity, certainly. And also discipline. And not going on our own path. It's unity and discipline. And hard work, of course. And work on the ground, of course. Things that the party didn't do as successfully at its early stages, but that's what I would say. But certainly discipline is important. And keeping an eye on that prize. Now, accepting, as Carl said, that Saunders Lewis was a very well-organized gentleman with a firm vision, I've never thought of him as a natural politician. Now, through what process, then, did he become leader of this new party? Well, he was quite unwilling as a leader. Originally, Valentine was the president for the first year. And Saunders Lewis wasn't particularly keen on becoming the Llywydd at the first summer school, and he says that himself, and he tries to resign many times, but he continues until 1939, but he's tried to leave the position many times. So he doesn't want to be in that leadership role, but he does want to lead. You can see from that section that we read from the Great War, he does want to tailor the nation and tailor the organization. He says himself at the end of his career that he tried to change Wales, but that he failed entirely. At the beginning, he wants to see Ambrose Bebb as leader. He says in a letter to Griffith John that you are an academic and nothing else, and neither am I. But Ambrose Bebb was the leader he wanted to see, but then Valentine was from the North Wales group, and he was already president in North Wales, and Saunders Lewis is eager to see him take the reign. And Saunders was the de facto leader. Valentine was more than willing to give up the reins because he was the de facto leader, but Saunders Lewis almost accepted the inevitable. He'd looked for others to take the role before taking it up himself. Yes, that's certainly true. But he enjoyed having that behind-the-scenes influence too. Well, I think that's what he would have liked to have done most, to actually have influence behind the scenes. He set the conditions for HR and nobody else. But there's a quote from R. Geraint Griffith, the son of Moses Griffith, who says that not one of the party founders were natural politicians. But he saw that as a disadvantage in one sense, but it was also an advantage because they wouldn't have been corrupted by party politics. So I don't know if it answers your question, but there we are. And I would also argue that the fact that they were not politicians had contributed to that spirit of unity and esprit de corps. There was nobody who was trying to be cock of the walk among them. And there, there's the novelty as well, of course. It was a modern, new organisation. And Saunders Lewis himself says that this isn't a narrow, parochial organisation. We want to be rid of that. That's been a cultural and political plague in Wales. It was a modern movement for the modern age in their eyes. Any further questions? Cynog. In 1926, Saunders Lewis gave his lecture on the principles of nationalism, and at first sight it's very strange that he, very near the beginning of that lecture, rejects the idea of independence. So two questions arise from that. Was that a contentious issue among people at that time? And secondly, although Saunders Lewis put forward a very strong philosophical case in favour of his view on independence, do you think that it was a signal of his practicality too, and that he was determined to put a practical stamp on the party in those very early days? Would you like to respond? Well, I think, and it's me that thinks this, in looking at all of this, the use of the word freedom. Now, it's very possible that it is a practical approach and that moving for independence wasn't practical in the position that Wales was in at the time. I think it's also a reflection of the indirect influence of Ireland and the Free State, in the sense that you're talking about 1926. The Free State has just been established to all intents and purposes. And some of the content of the principles of nationalism in that area do reflect or are a mirror, perhaps, of the Free State and the conditions that the Free State work under in terms of the empire, because it wasn't a republic immediately. Now, these are just my thoughts in having looked into this, and the fact that one of the first speakers at the first summer school, Kevin O'Shiel, who was quite high up in the Free State government, and many of the ideas of the Free State fed into that speech in terms of gaining power locally first rather than going to Westminster and so on. Now, time is short to go into detail, but I do think you're right in saying that it's a reflection of his pragmatism and practicality, despite the way he sets things down. He does lay the law down, but he knows how and when to change and how to adapt when the need arises, and I think we demonstrate that elsewhere in the book too. But again, that isn't a full answer to your question, I realise that. Well, our time is almost up, but I would like to ask just one final question, which is a little mischievous perhaps, but I read this volume at the time of Tafwyl, and I was thinking myself in Tafwyl. Tafwyl was very jolly this year, and perhaps more inclusive than I've seen it in the past, but the Welsh language was still there in all its glory. And I was thinking to myself, I wonder if these people were to go to Tafwyl and walk around, would they think that they'd succeeded? I certainly thought that Tafwyl wouldn't have happened this year if it wasn't for what they did 100 years ago. But how would they feel if they'd gone to Tafwyl? Would they feel that they'd been successful? Gwen, first on this. They would be very proud, I'm sure, and pleased that things are looking so positive now. They would be pleased to see us here this evening with the centre of government and with Tafwyl. And I am like a stuck record, but it was a modern organisation. They were young people and they would have enjoyed being in the company of other young people. Saunders and Valentine, when they write to each other at the end of their lives, actually delight in their grandchildren, many of whom were culturally and politically active. So they would have enjoyed being there in the company of young people, and they would have seen those encouraging elements. They, perhaps, because you do have to bear in mind that there were discussions at this time between cultural nationalism, which was represented by O.M. Edwards and his son, even though Ivan Ab almost joined up, but that's another story. But there was cultural nationalism and political nationalism. And I think that they would take pride in Tafwyl, yes, but they would also see and they would be gravely concerned about the situation of the Welsh language in its traditional heartlands in North and West Wales. And it would be a dichotomy, I suppose. There would be that joy that there were young Welsh speakers who could enjoy themselves through the medium of Welsh, and that happened even now a century later. But there's also this ongoing problem of the threat to the future of the Welsh language as a viable community language. And then, if I could go on, they would have seen a Senedd established, and that in and of itself would be seen as miraculous, and that they had succeeded to some extent. But if I can paraphrase the words of Saunders, when he sees DJ coming off the train and he says, well, it started. Well, yes, it started, but it's not finished. It's unfinished work. It's an unfinished revolution in terms of a free Wales. Well, I think that that is a very appropriate point for us to draw the evening to the close. The work is not done, but thanks to them, it started and it continues. Thank you both very much for this evening. Thank you for writing this very important book and the work that you've done on it. And thank you for the pleasure that it will give so many people as they read it, because it is very entertaining as well as being educational. Can I thank Carl and Elin Edwish, because she's made most of the arrangements for this evening. And she's a relative of E.T. John, she told me in March. And thank you to the interpreter too, and everyone else who's been involved in